Hello, I'm Eric Corman, Communications Director at League of Education Voters. In our podcast, we interview policymakers, partners, and thought leaders to spotlight education policies, research, and practices so that together we can create a brighter future for every Washington student. This episode is the first in a series about the impact of COVID-19 on communities around Washington State. Open Doors for Multicultural Families, also known as Open Doors or ODMF, provides culturally and linguistically relevant information, services, and programming to culturally and linguistically diverse families of persons with developmental and intellectual disabilities. The families they serve are often immigrants, refugees, and/or people of color. They accomplish this using a cultural brokerage model. Their staff come from the same culture and speak the same language as the families they serve, and so are able to communicate with the family in their own language and in a way that will make sense within their cultural context. Additionally, these staff are knowledgeable of disability services, special education, and other mainstream social services, and to bridge the gap between the families they serve and the services they need. Currently, their bilingual, bicultural direct support staff provide services in English, Spanish, Somali, Korean, Mandarin Chinese, Cantonese, Arabic, Vietnamese, Amharic, Tigrinya, Ukrainian, Russian, and Kurdish. Info at multiculturalfamilies.org. Joy Sebe is Advocacy and Civic Engagement Program Manager, Director of the Community Parent Resource Center, and a mother of two sons in the public school system. Joy, thank you so much for taking a minute to talk to me.
Thank you, Eric, for having me.
You are very welcome. What does the community served by Open Doors need right now in this time of remote learning? And right now, the landscape is even dramatically different than it was even just a couple months ago when this time of remote learning began. We have racial equity front and center in a way that it probably never has been.
Yeah, thank you, Eric. For Open Doors was founded 10 years ago, really to address inequities in the access that culturally and linguistically diverse individuals with disabilities and their families have to services and programs. And so we've seen for years the institutionalized barriers, institutionalized racism and ableism that have existed all along. And during COVID-19 and this current situation, it's really highlighted more than ever the barriers. And so as different families went on to go into online and remote learning, and there were a lot of conversations about access to education, at Open Doors, we were really focused and continue to be focused on emergency response. Mm. So how do we get families food to eat, rent so that they can stay housed? So really addressing those basic needs first before students and families can even consider how to access their online learning platforms, how to log into technology. And so really right now, we continue to be focused on emergency assistance. And then for those families who we do connect to emergency assistance, then we layer in and look at their access to their education, including access to continuous learning plans. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, how big has access been in terms of an issue to be addressed? Have you found that most of the families do have at least technology access? I'm also curious about how language access is being addressed.
I would say that it's really variable, that there are some students and families who've had good relationships with their school staff and teachers who are able to access. But for the most part, for the vast majority of our students and families, they are not able to access learning. We can assume that they're not learning. There are multiple barriers, including access to interpreters and translation, so language access, which really is the foundation for meaningful communication with really anyone, including with educators. Other barriers on top of that, and that is access to technology. So first you need to get the laptop, then you need to learn how to log into the Microsoft Teams or Zoom or whatever platform, how to use it. All of the communication about how to access the links and how to go in and teach your child, those are all primarily in English. right? Mm-hmm. And so then families are also coming from different educational backgrounds. So if, for example, my parents who are immigrants had to teach me how to write an essay in English, they wouldn't have been able to. And so the same educational background barriers exist for our families. It's not just a one note issue. There's layers upon layers. Meet basic needs first, then technology, then use of technology, then educational background to access the learning. And then there are students who have disabilities, including my children, for whom it is difficult to stay concentrated on a screen for long periods of time, and then to gather instruction from a screen and then translate that somehow into some product that they're then supposed to produce and then send back to their teachers. And so this is a challenging situation.
Have you heard certain themes rise up, especially when it comes to the start of the school year in the fall? Because it looks like there's going to be some sort of hybrid of remote and in-person learning. We don't know quite what that is yet. We hope that we'll learn more by the end of the week. What are you hearing that seems to be most front and center when it comes to reopening schools, or at least the start of the school year?
Right. So families are concerned. There's kind of three main issues that I'm hearing. One is safety. Is it safe to go back to school? Number two, what's going to happen as my children have not been able to access their education? And so how are we going to make up for the loss of social, emotional, behavior, and academic learning? And then the other question is, when schools are starting up in this hybrid model and families need to get back to work, what childcare will be provided so that families can return to work? That's a key one. But safety is really a concern, right? Because we're having to learn as adults how to social distance. Masks are uncomfortable. But what about young children, children with disabilities? All of that is going to have to be learned behavior. Learn behavior for educators, learn behavior for children. So I think it's going to be a tremendous learning curve across the board.
Absolutely. And I think about just access to healthcare, for example, because I mean, it's one thing for someone who does have robust healthcare that's provided through their employer, et cetera. But for a lot of families, especially immigrant families, they don't have that same sort of healthcare support. So it would be certainly devastating for many families to come down with COVID-19. But for certain families, it could be a whole other level of difficult.
Right, absolutely. So when you say that, I think of our undocumented families who, yes, given the new changes to the public charge ruling, there's fears associated with going to the hospital, being placed on public, some form of medical record. We have many undocumented families who are pulling out of necessary services, disability-related services that they need out of some legitimate fears about the repercussions of being within a government system.
Yeah. So what can we do to provide support? Are there advocacy opportunities or other areas where we can engage with this to support families who need it most?
So I think that there are many levels that we all could work together. One is, given the real disproportionalities for Black students with disabilities, to really kind of reassess our advocacy priorities now to see how our priorities are focusing on eliminating the disproportionate exclusionary discipline, the graduation outcomes, the post-secondary outcomes that our Black students with disabilities and their families experience. And that's true also for our Native students or Pacific Islander students, Latinx students, and students within some Asian categories once the data is disaggregated. And so at Open Doors, we're kind of really engaged in conversations internally right now because we have such diverse staff, and really recognizing that that bias really exists across all cultural communities. And so we're engaging in some difficult and honest conversations about Black history, about the systemic and intentional racism and oppression of the Black community, and hoping to come out of that with a greater understanding and greater trust, and then redirecting possibly our efforts to make sure that we're addressing those families that are most disproportionately impacted.
Now, do you see the opportunities primarily at the school district level, or do you see opportunities as well at the state level?
It's at all levels, right? So there's certainly advocacy that we're engaged in at the state level, but then we're also told over and over again that Washington State is a local control state. And so there's certainly advocacy that needs to happen at school district, city, county, all of those levels. What we have also seen really across the board is that community-based organizations that are led by and for people of color are really kind of left out of conversations, left out of decision-making tables, receive less funding with more strings attached. And so as a member of the King County Racial Equity Coalition, we've really been trying to push hard on access to emergency food and rental assistance to ensure that funding is going to the communities that are most impacted with the least number of barriers. But I think it is really going to take all of us working together to address those systemic barriers, whether it's us working within communities of color across cultural communities, or with families and schools, with teachers on the ground and their administrators, really all across the board.
And for our listeners who are from white communities, how can they best be of a support? A friend of mine said the other day, how to be an accomplice instead of just an ally, to really get in there and do the work instead of just saying, hey, we support you.
Yeah, that is a tricky question. I guess I don't have an answer for all the white community members. What I am doing personally is reaching out to my white family members, my white in-laws, colleagues, friends, and valuing really the impact that my white friends and family have on my everyday life. And so what I've been doing is kind of engaging in really honest and very uncomfortable conversations about the way that they have hurt me, and then kind of hold them accountable for doing better because of the love and trust that I have for them. I don't have anything like a blanket statement for like all the white people out there. It is really critical that white folks educate themselves and have conversations amongst each other without expecting people of color to educate you. I'm doing that for particular people who I love and trust, but I'm not doing that for most of the people who I know.
Yeah, and that's yeah. Very helpful. Yeah, and that makes perfect sense. We who are white definitely have to take upon ourselves to acknowledge what has happened up to this point historically and systemically. Since we collectively created this, I think it's on us to fix it as well, but not in a vacuum either. So Joy, in your own educational journey, what worked and what didn't work so well?
I guess in my own education, I didn't speak English very much when I entered elementary school. I didn't really know what was going on. When I was in second grade, I just learned that the school staff reached out to my parents to ask if I wanted to be in the English language learner program. What worked for me is that people had high expectations of me. Hmm. The teachers and my peers and my family assumed that I would succeed and then gave me the resources and opportunities to allow me to succeed. I think often we don't expect students of color and students of color with disabilities to achieve and perform at the level that they can. Mm-hmm. But that is a really critical part, I think, of my success. What didn't work, there's a lot of things that didn't work. You know, I went to a school across the board, particularly in high school, where there was a lot of really overt racism by teachers, by peers, a lot of violence. So those things certainly didn't work. what I think has been most damaging to me over the years that I've just started to really realize is the internalized racism that I held within me because of not only my education, but just of the things people say and the things that people expected of me. So for example, Japanese Americans were interned, they were imprisoned. And so because of that, as I reflect on it, there's a need sometimes within my community to assimilate or to kind of reach out and think about almost getting validation from the white community, because there has been really systemic practices meant to silence us. I see it in my family, that internalized racism within my family, within myself, and I'm just really beginning to kind of think about it and unpack it and figure out how I can do better by my family and my community as well.
Thank you so much for sharing. As schools begin making their plans for reopening in the fall or some sort of hybrid model, what would you like to see schools prioritize as they begin the new school year in 2020-2021?
I think number one is the need to prioritize the relationships that school staff have with families. All conversations, all plans need to be made with a prioritization of what families and students need right now, what they've gone through, and then prioritizing the relationships and healing, and then building the relationships. And so everything that I say next is really with the mindset of you're going to be involving families to check how all of this can be done in a culturally responsive way. So I would say that number one, there really needs to be universal mental health supports, assuming that children have experienced trauma during the pandemic and are coming back with trauma, and assuming that behavior, all behavior, is a form of communication. So whether that behavior is considered challenging or acceptable, all of that behavior is a form of communication and requires really intentional and universal social emotional supports and mental health supports for children before learning can even be considered. The other thing that I would say is that we really need to ensure that immigrant and refugee families have access to communication, meaningful communication between themselves and school staff. And so that means not just an interpreter on the line, but a really qualified interpreter who can help families communicate in a meaningful way so that school staff who really want to learn what the children and families need, that they can get that information with fidelity.
League of Education Voters is right there with you. We cannot agree more. Joy Sebe is Advocacy and Civic Engagement Program Manager and Director of the Community Parent Resource Center at Open Doors for Multicultural Families. info@multiculturalfamilies.org. Joy, thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you so much, Eric.
And thank you for listening. To learn more about League of Education Voters or to support our work, please visit educationvoters.org.